Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
With Car Guru's Discover, you can skip the filters and describe what you're looking for in your own words. Simply type what you want, and Car Guru's Discover instantly surfaces real listings that match your exact needs. It's no wonder Car Guru's is the number one most visited car shopping site, according to SimilarWeb's estimated traffic data. Buy or sell your next car today with Car Guru's at CarGurus.com. Go to CarGurus.com to make sure your big deal is the best deal. That's CarGurus.com. CarGurus.com.
Welcome to the 338th episode of the 4th and 24 podcast with Patrick Windegrad. I'm your host today, Patrick Windegrad. In this edition, our topics are a review of my weekend predictions, a quick Super Bowl preview, our weekly look at the NBA, a recap of the past week in college basketball, and a quick look at the end of the Australian Open. So let's jump right in with a look back at my weekend predictions. Starting in college basketball, where I went 3-1. In the NBA, I went 2-2. In Australian Open men's action, I went 1-1. And then in women's action, I went 1-0. Unfortunately, the clock there only allowed me to pick the women's final and the men's semifinal. So a little bit unfortunate there, but it is what it is. But overall, 7-4 this week. 14-82-932 is now the overall record, a 61.4% winning percentage. I thought it was a pretty good week of predictions. Going back to college basketball, pretty much a toss-up in that Michigan State rivalry game. Picked Michigan State as an emotional hedge there. We've talked about picking games like that plenty of times before, and that is definitely the method I use in that one. But Michigan, of course, won that game. That was the only game I got wrong this weekend. Number 14 Kansas beat number 13 BYU 90-82 in the matchup of the two lottery picks there, between high lottery picks, I should say, between Darren Peterson and A.J. DePonsa. Big win for Kansas there as well. I will talk more about them in a second. But number 19 Florida beat number 23 Alabama 100-77. Just a dominant win for the Gators, who are looking like the team that should contend for the SEC and maybe even for the national title at this point. Then you have number 9 Illinois, who beat number 5 Nebraska 78-69 on the road, avenging their earlier season loss. Even with no Kylan Boswell. And I predicted all three of those last games correct, so very happy with those results. In the NBA, I went 2-2. The Suns beat the Pistons 114-96, and the Timberwolves beat the Thunder 123-111. Pretty ironic that the two games I got wrong were picking the best teams in the West and in the East. And those were the predictions that ended up being wrong because, well, I think it's just pretty ironic. But anyway, still happy, still okay with those predictions. It is what it is. And then the Magic beat the Raptors 130-120. And the Knicks beat the Lakers 112-100, which I got those final two correct. In tennis predictions, I predicted that Sinner would beat Djokovic and Alcaraz would beat Zverev. Of course, Djokovic came out with the win against Sinner, although definitely was helped by the rest that he got earlier in the tournament due to all the walkovers and retirements. It is what it is, though. I also had that information, so I could have went with him on that pick if I wanted to. But got the Alcaraz pick right, got the Djokovic pick wrong. On the women's side, though, Elena Rybakina ended up with the title win over Aryna Sabalenka. I actually did predict that, which, you know, based on the seedings, looks odd. But the reality is these two have played a ton before. I think Sabalenka owns the head-to-head by three, or maybe by two, or did heading into this match. I remember that when I was doing research to make this prediction, I noticed that Sabalenka has the edge, but Rybakina actually has the edge, or they're 6-6 or something like that on hard courts. It's either completely even or Rybakina has the edge. And Sabalenka has the head-to-head edge overall because of the three matches that they played that haven't been on hard court. They're on clay or on grass. And obviously this tournament final being played on a hard court. And also Sabalenka, I think, won their first three matchups overall. and is 3-6 or something like that in the matchup since that are actually on hard court. So I picked Rybakina for those reasons, and she won again. I mean, I think she beat her in Riyadh last year, towards the end of the year as well. So not entirely as surprising as maybe some casual fans would think. But when you look into the matchup a little bit more, that head-to-head definitely in Rybakina's favor recently. It's the part of the reason why she's climbed to number 5 in the world. Very, very high ranking and a great title for her. But that's all I have for weekend predictions. Thought it was a good week. Now time to move on to a preview of the Super Bowl, which, of course, not going to take quite as long as our past, you know, reviews of NFL action. But I think, look, there's a lot of speculation about quarterback injuries in this game. You know, will that impact everything? How will it impact everything, if it does at all? I don't think it's even worth talking about. I think, in all honesty, it's the Super Bowl. We have 2 weeks off for both of these teams, and I think that generally it's just going to be, you know, Drake May is going to figure it out, Sam Darnold is going to figure it out, and they're just going to have to gut it out with their injuries. And the Seahawks, I think, you know, they have the better defense. I think arguably you could say they have the better offense too. I mean, obviously the Patriots, I think we'd all agree that Drake May is definitely the better quarterback in the Darnold and May matchup. But even that, honestly, has been debatable at times this year. Darnold has been on fire, especially when healthy and, you know, playing against the right teams. The Seahawks offense, he's turnover prone for sure, but it's explosive when it's going right. And the fact that he has JSN complimenting him, it means that even if he might be the worst overall player, his stats end up looking pretty darn good when you look at the end of the game, because he has just a good complement to throw to, especially with JSN, and then the addition of Rashid Shaheed as well. Cooper Kupp always kind of a steadying presence for him, and then even the screen game that they've gotten going with Kenneth Walker in a few of their games has been pretty instrumental to what they've done recently. And I think overall, you know, despite the Charbonnet injury, despite Darnold still nagging oblique injury, and whatever might happen with Drake May's injury, I still think I'm just going to pick the team that I think is the better team, and has been the better team all season long. I mean, I said it last week, Seahawks and the Rams felt like the matchup where the winner of that wins the Super Bowl, and I'm not going to back off of that now. I have really no reason to. I've kind of maintained that take for a while, so I do think that the Seahawks go ahead and win this game. I think it will be a very entertaining game, although it might be a little bit low scoring, a little more of a vintage look. Probably not the game that we saw with the Seahawks and the Rams. I think either of these teams are fine playing a lower possession, not back and forth game, if the other team will kind of drag them down into that. And I think that honestly, that's how this game is going to play out. I don't think it's going to be super high possession back and forth type of a game at all. I think that Seahawks defense has looked dominant as it has throughout the season, but especially in the playoffs. And I think, you know, other than the Rams, who kind of, you know, they have that experience, they know the tendencies, they've had all that time to scout them, and they scout them a ton. No one's really been able to solve them outside of LA. And I think that's just because they have probably the best offense in the league, whereas the Patriots do not. And I think that recently, especially, I mean, I know there's been some bad weather that the Patriots have dealt with, but they haven't looked all that clean. So, no, no. I don't think you can really just, you know, set this matchup in stone. I also don't think you can say no matter what, this is going to be a really, really, really low scoring game. I don't think that in reality, I don't think that I would ever advise anybody to say that this is going to be a high scoring game. If you say you have to pick the over or the under, I'm definitely picking the under in this game because I trust both defenses a lot more than I trust either offense. But overall, should be a really, really exciting game. Definitely picking the Seahawks, though. Obviously, they're pretty heavy favorites. I'd say 4.5 points on the spread for a Super Bowl is a really big gap, considering this is a neutral site game, the only neutral site game we pretty much ever get in the NFL other than the international game. So really interesting matchup, but definitely going with the Seahawks there. And now we can move on to a quick recap of the last weekend or the last week in the NBA. Starting in the Eastern Conference, we have the Detroit Pistons at the top. They are 36-12. 5.5 games back of them are the Knicks and the Celtics, who are tied for the second and third seeds. The Pistons have gone 8-2 in their last 10. The Knicks have won 6 in a row. And then the Celtics 7-3 in their last 10. So really good records all around there at the top of the East. The two teams that, kind of expect to be up there, the Knicks and the Celtics, and then also the team that has been up there all season long. It doesn't look like they're showing any signs of stopping and slowing down there. Then you have the Raptors and the Cavs, who are 7.5 back of the Pistons, 2 back of the Knicks and the Celtics. They're both tied for the 4 and the 5 seeds currently. The Raptors 6-4 in their last 10. Meanwhile, the Cavs playing really well recently. They're 8-2 in their last 10. The Sixers, who are in the 6th seed currently at 9 games back, 1.5 back of the Cavs and the Raptors. They got some bad news, though, of course, of the Paul George suspension, although they've still won 3 games in a row. So seeming like so far, so good. But they'll be back in time for the playoffs, and that'll be, I guess it's good enough. I don't know. Maybe I'm not the best person to talk about this. Maybe someone who's an actual Sixers fan has a different opinion on this. There are some, a lot of people talking about this situation in terms of what actually happened. Just kind of vague information here. It's a very low suspension for, a substance related issue, I guess. Maybe from an MLB perspective, especially, it's a very low number of games. But the reality is, it's a different sport, and they don't really have that issue as much. So maybe they don't feel the need to go out and suspend a player for as long as MLB does, where they've obviously had those issues way in the past, and they need to keep curtailing them. As we've seen with Fernando Tatis, Emmanuel Clase, recent stars to kind of have that issue. So it's kind of different in basketball, though. I feel like I really haven't. I don't even think I have a comparison of who else this has happened to. So makes sense that the suspension is kind of smaller, and we'll see what happens later in the season with Paul George. Obviously, the Sixers have dealt with plenty of availability issues throughout the year and throughout the years, really, between Embiid and also Paul George now. But still in the 16th, then you have the Heat in the play-in bracket. They're 10.5 back. 1.5 back of the Sixers for that 6 seed. They have the same amount of wins, though. They just have 3 extra losses. 27-24 is their record. The Magic were the last team above 500 in the East, just a half game back of the Heat in that 8 seed currently. Then you have the Bulls at 24-26. They're 2 back of the Magic. And the Hawks, who are 24-27, they are a half game behind the Bulls. Just behind those teams, you have the Hornets, who have won 7 games in a row, and all of a sudden, at 23-28, they look like a playoff team, and not just a play, and not a play-in team. I mean, a serious playoff team. This team has been playing great basketball recently. Obviously, a very, very young core, but hey, that team is—they're performing. I mean, we know that they're young, but they are playing some really, really good basketball right now. And then you also have the Bucks, who are there amidst all the Giannis rumors. They've lost 5 in a row. They're 3 back of the Hornets. We'll see where he might end up, or if they, for some reason, decide not to trade him, although I think it's looking pretty likely that they're going to. But then you have the Nets. They're 13-35. So are the Wizards. Each of those two way out of a playoff spot. And then finally, the Pacers at the bottom of the East at 13-37. In the West, you have the Thunder at 39-11, still the best record overall in the league, although the Pistons not too far behind at this point, just one back in the loss column there. Of course, 3 back overall in the win column too, so a little bit farther separation, but still, it's closer than you'd think it would be based on Oklahoma City's start to the season. And also not too far behind them in the West. It's actually the same deficit now from first to second. The Spurs at 5.5 games back. The Nuggets, not too far behind the Spurs. They're 33-17. They're a half game behind the Spurs, who are 33-16. You have the Houston Rockets, who are 31-17, so same amount of losses as the Nuggets, two fewer wins. They are 1 game back of the Nuggets, and of course that makes them 1.5 back of the Spurs for the 2 seed. So very, very close at the top there. Just behind that group of teams, you have the Timberwolves at 31-20. They are 1.5 behind the Rockets, who, of course, I forgot to mention, are 8-2 in their last 10. So best mark in the league there, along with the Hornets and also the Pistons and also the Cavs and also the Clippers, who we'll get to in a second. But before we get down to the play-in bracket, you also have the Lakers and the Suns, who are a half game behind the Timberwolves. Currently tied on that spot that is the borderline between the playoff bracket and the play-in bracket at 6 and 7. The Lakers 29-19, Suns 30-20. The Warriors are 3 games back of that bunch of 2 teams at 27-23. Then the Clippers, probably the best under 500 team in the league by far, although I guess you could put Charlotte in that conversation too, but they're 23-25, 3 games behind the Warriors. Squarely in the playoff bracket, though, they're a game ahead of the Blazers, who are 23-27. They've lost 5 in a row. The Grizzlies are 3 games out. They are 3-7 in their last 10. They're 19-29. The Mavericks are 19-30, 3.5 games back of the Trailblazers. They've lost 4 in a row. The Jazz are 15-35, way out of the bunch, and have lost 6 in a row and also 1-9 in their last 10, which is the worst, only topped by the Kings, who have lost 9 in a row and are 1-9 at the bottom of the West at 12-39, and just ahead of the Kings and between the Jazz and Sacramento are the New Orleans Pelicans, who are 13-39. So, very interesting things going on in the NBA, obviously nearing the trade deadline too, which is kind of interesting. Although a little bit of a quiet deadline so far, a lot of rumors and not a lot of actual solid movement yet. But we'll see if that action picks up soon, and when it does, we'll of course be here to talk about it again next week. But for now, that's all we have for the NBA recap. Now it's time to talk about college basketball, where it's a pretty big week. I guess it was unofficially rivalry weekend. I guess maybe Michigan State is probably the best way to explain that it was rivalry weekend, but also some big matchups all around. I guess you could call Kentucky and Arkansas a rivalry game, and same as Gonzaga St. Mary's. Obviously, some bigger matchups looming. Arizona State also, I guess, is a rivalry. But look, it started off with Michigan, number 3 team in the country, beating undefeated Nebraska 75-72. Nebraska again coming into that game 20-0, although they did not have Braden Frager or Rank Mass in that game. So worth noting that. Tough environment on the road for the Cornhuskers to go in and even stay close in based on those injuries. Or I guess in Rank Mass' case, the flu. And then Frager's case, an injury. But look, great game by Michigan. They fought back after Nebraska just shot lights out in the first half. It was an ugly second half on both ends, but the Wolverines end up winning that one. Then you have number 2 UConn, who had to squeak by Providence a little bit, but they did win 87-81. It's an okay win for UConn. I mean, they really have not looked the part of the number 2 team in the country recently, and that has been reflected by the fact that they've since been demoted from that spot to number 3, although I think Duke's probably better than them by a considerable margin too. But we'll get to that point later in the season. Obviously, we know that AP poll rankings don't really mean much. But then you have number 7 Michigan State. They went on the road. They beat Rutgers 88-79, although this game did have to go to overtime. Maybe Michigan State caught looking ahead a little bit too much to that rivalry matchup. Speaking of rivalries, also Indiana beat number 12 Purdue 72-67. They were honoring Fernando Mendoza, Kurt Cignetti, and crew at that game for their football national championship. And, you know, I mean, I think I even put it out there that, look, it's crazy that we live in a world where we're talking about Michigan, Nebraska, Indiana, and Purdue playing basketball back to back on the same network. And Indiana is the team celebrating the football national championship. And Michigan, Nebraska is the top 5 basketball matchup, while the Indiana Hoosiers are the unranked team in basketball. Just very crazy how things can change, especially in the NIL era. But speaking of how fast things can change, number 18 Vanderbilt beat Kentucky 80-55. You want to talk about two teams that flipped fashions? Not saying that Vanderbilt is like an all-time bad program or anything in the SEC, but obviously Kentucky, an all-time juggernaut, not used to getting blown out by Vanderbilt. Definitely have lost a few games there before, but most of those upsets not the expected result. Whereas in this one, the Commodores definitely were the favorites heading in, and they showed that on the court. Then your number 10 Houston, they beat TCU 79-70. Big win for the Cougars to go on the road and get. Number 9 Illinois beat Washington at home 75-66, a solid win for them. They continue to navigate life without Kylan Boswell, where that means that, you know, of course, Keaton Wagler taking the initiative and really running the point for them, and obviously has ascended into lottery pick discussions because of how well he's taken over that role. More from him later in the week. But number 3 Michigan beat number 7 Michigan State 83-71. Of course, probably the talk of the week for a lot of different reasons, maybe some of them not the right ones. But Michigan, of course, coming up with two top 10 wins in the same week, two top seven wins, if you want to narrow that down even more to a to an unconventional threshold there. But Michigan really reasserting what they can do when they're playing at their peak. I mean, we've seen them play Penn State close. They lost at home to Wisconsin. They've had some ups and downs in there, kind of mixed in. I mean, even the Oregon or the Washington games, both of them probably closer than anybody would have expected. But the reality is, this team still has the capability to just go out and beat anybody. And really, I mean, Michigan State probably led for a minute and a half of this game total. Michigan came out there up 10-2. Michigan State made their run to make it closer. Eventually, did take a lead and then kind of went back and forth for a little bit, and then Michigan regained control of that lead and didn't really look back from there. I think when you talk about this Michigan team, the thing that made them historically good at the beginning of the season, or on pace to be historically good, is the fact that the Wolverines just would come out on these runs, like they did against Michigan State, for the record, in this game where it was 10-2. But then the issue was they didn't stop there. I mean, the lead just kept building. Anytime that you thought you'd have momentum, 5-0 spurt, 6-0 spurt, it would just flip immediately back. Michigan would have a run of their own, especially in Vegas in the Players Era tournament. That's something that we haven't quite seen from Michigan since then. They have been able to make their own runs, make it back into games, close out games, win games, whether that's close or by double digits, even if, okay, they should have won by 20 and they won by 12. I mean, that's whatever. It's a bit, not that big of a deal. But I think this game was kind of that example where Michigan led this game by 16 at the half. I think it was pretty much near 20. And there was a very good stretch at the end of the first half where Michigan could have made it probably 25 if they had gotten a stop and a score themselves. And instead, it turned into points for Michigan State going the other way. And that ended up being the reason that this game ended up, at 16 at the half, and then all of a sudden Michigan State makes their run, and instead of countering, Michigan really takes a while to adapt to that run that the Spartans make, and all of a sudden you have a tight game again, which is, I think, the difference that Michigan has had. They haven't been so quick to just annihilate other teams going on runs. That has been the bigger thing in recent times. But Michigan still. Only one loss. Obviously, it's setting up a really big club. Well, it's setting up two big games. Of course, with Duke playing in DC at a neutral site game in a few weeks, that could be a very, very big number one seed debate kind of a game. And then also against Illinois, that could also be another game that factors in the one seed. And those two currently top two teams in the Big Ten. So that will also have those implications as well. But then you have number 21 St. Louis. They beat Dayton 102-71, reasserting, not reasserting, but just continuing to assert just how dominant they are for the rest of their conference. Number one Arizona, you want to talk about dominance, beat Arizona State 87-74. They stayed on top, stayed undefeated. UConn beat Creighton 85-58. Number four Duke beat Virginia Tech 72-58. Number six Gonzaga beat St. Mary's 73-65. St. Mary's, I wouldn't say missing an opportunity to be like to lock up a tournament bid, but it would be pretty close if they were able to get that road win against Gonzaga. Although Gonzaga beating St. Mary's, also that's kind of their best. That might be their best win of the year, in conference, of course. But it's hard to knock this team down. They're not going to really fall in the AP poll, but they should be fading, frankly, as the season goes on, because these other teams that get big wins but just lose a little bit, I think they deserve to kind of fall down a little bit if you're talking about the Gonzagas of the world, in comparison to a team like Kansas that I'm going to talk about in a second. But it is what it is. Speaking of Kansas' next opponent, though, UCF beat number 11 Texas Tech 88-80. That was before number 14 Kansas beat number 13 BYU 90-82. And then, of course, get to what happened when those teams played each other in a second. But Kentucky beat number 15 Arkansas 85-77. This team, I know I went on a little bit of a Michigan rant in terms of what's happening with their season. Kentucky's season is just, a mess. I have no clue what this team is doing from game to game. One game, they're down, I don't know, 10 or 12 or whatever it was at the half to LSU. I mean, even the next half in that game, they're dominating that game. They're shooting threes, they're hitting them. They're shorthanded and still working out. And then the next game, they're flat against Vanderbilt. They're losing by 25. And then they just turn around and go beat Arkansas on the road. I mean, this team does not make sense. You can't even say it's the injury issues at this point because they should be used to just not playing as a full unit. Especially because at this point, Jalen Lowe and Jaden Quaintance are kind of the two injured guys that have really been out for a while. Obviously, Cam Williams being injured is kind of a new development. But those original two, they played without them for most of the beginning of the season, and they haven't played most of the season with them in the middle part of it either. So it really shouldn't be a struggle. And in games like this against Arkansas, it wasn't a struggle, but some other games it has been. It's just really, really, really hard to get a read on this team. And frankly, I don't know what Mark Pope's thinking about his own team there himself. But they did get the win this weekend. Keeps them in the tournament picture, pretty high seeded up there. I mean, not high seeded, but 8 or 9 seed. Which is a really dangerous sight because they do have a lot of talent, and if they're playing at their peak, they're a pretty dangerous team. But then you got number 18 Vanderbilt. They beat Ole Miss 71-68. Number 20 Louisville beat SMU 88-74. Good win at home. SMU was actually leading for most of the first half in that one, but Louisville got control towards the middle portion of the game. Illinois beat Purdue. I mean, sorry, Illinois beat Nebraska. Excuse me, they beat Purdue last week. 78-69, which we talked about in predictions. Purdue beat Maryland 93-63 on the road, finally snapping their 3-game losing streak. And then number 19 Florida beat Alabama 100-77, as we talked about in predictions again. And finally, the game that I had teased a little bit earlier, Kansas beat Texas Tech 64-61. Darren Peterson scoring the last 6 points of this game. Christian Anderson kind of going in and out with injuries, so take it with a grain of salt, but still, Kansas getting a huge road win against Texas Tech. They will climb into the top 10 this week, barring, well, an upset loss later in the week. Don't exactly know who they play, but I hope it's not Arizona because then obviously that would not be an upset. But I think I know that game is looming soon, and maybe Kansas has the best chance of any team in the Big 12. I think definitely Houston would be my pick, but someone's got to dethrone Arizona, you'd assume at some point. And yeah, it's Kansas, Arizona next Monday, excuse me. But still, that game is looming. Their next game is against Utah at home. Do not think they're losing to Utah, at Phog Allen. So Kansas should come into that game, in the top 10, pretty very likely that they're in that top 10. And that'll set up a top 10 matchup at the Fog between Kansas and what will likely still be an undefeated Arizona team. Although, again, college basketball is crazy. Arizona could lose. Don't think they're losing to Oklahoma State at home, though. So for both teams, not likely that they'll lose. It'll set up a big clash next week. I'm sure everybody will have a ton of fun watching that. But speaking of big clashes, to end the podcast, we're going to take a look at the Australian Open. Starting on the men's side, we're in the semifinals. Carlos Alcaraz beat Alexander Zverev 6-4, 7-6, 6-7, 6-7, 7-5. Alcaraz just doing Alcaraz things. I mean, obviously went down here. He had some potential cramping issues in this game. It looked like he might have been injured. Looked like he might have retired. Looked like he made the move to even. He kind of pump faked the handshake, saying "I'm retiring." Zverev decided to continue on. Ended up coming back to win the match again. Just Alcaraz being Alcaraz. I mean, there's not much else you can say about it. The dude is just kind of a beast. But Djokovic, speaking of guys who just you can't explain it anymore. I mean, the fact that he's still out here competing with these guys at this tournament is ridiculous. I think, everybody has talked about how nobody can beat the big two, and still you have Djokovic, who is obviously way past his prime, and he could still beat these guys. I mean, no, he's not beating Alcaraz on a regular basis. Not exactly beating Sinner on a regular basis either. I don't think regular basis is the word to use, but he's taken some game. He always takes a few sets off of these two, and he definitely steals his matches every once in a while. And in the semifinals, he had Sinner's number. He went down 3-6 early, but then won the second set, evened it up 6-3. Was down going into the fourth 4-6, but then Sinner really in these longer matches, as we know, has had his fair share of struggles. Not great in five set matches. For you know, well, not great is a little bit of a knock at him. But the reality is, for as great of a player as he is, when you get him to the fourth or fifth set, he does tend to lose a little bit of that impact that he has earlier in the match. He's so hard to beat if he's able to jump on top of you early. But later in matches, he's more susceptible for whatever reason. So Djokovic able to exploit that, Sinner losing another five setter. And then in the finals, Alcaraz beat Djokovic. Djokovic did take the first set off of Alcaraz 6-2, and then Alcaraz came storming back, won the final three sets 6-2, 6-3, 6-7-5, excuse me, to win the Australian Open, complete the career slam for him. Seven Grand Slam titles since 2022 for Alcaraz now, and I'd assume he'll add at least an eighth before the end of the year, if not a ninth, and potentially even a tenth. So Alcaraz, I mean, again, this is the only tournament he hadn't won at. He has two titles at each of the other Grand Slam events, so it's very, very possible that he'll be not only in the mix, but the favorite, and should be the favorite for all of the three remaining Grand Slams this year, and might win all three, frankly. I mean, this is a guy who is very clearly a perennial contender to be a Grand Slam champion, and not just a Grand Slam champion, but win a calendar slam. I mean, he easily has the capability to do it. Two US Opens, and again, he was missing the Australian Open, which is a hard court tournament. You could argue hard courts are one of his better surfaces. So I think it's just, I mean, it's hard to beat this guy anywhere, but the reality is he really has a chance at the calendar slam this year. The way that he's playing, the way that he started out this year, it looks like he's just somehow gotten even better. And he just doesn't really stop getting better. So, barring anything crazy, definitely will be a contender for the calendar slam. Expect to see him in the finals of all these tournaments, regardless. But on the women's side, you have Sabalenka, who beats Svitolina 6-2, 6-3. Svitolina had a great run throughout this tournament to even make it this far, obviously. Not one of the younger players on the tournament, just using her experience. Obviously, has Gael Monfils in her box with her. Just a lot of experience between those two, a lot of big matches that have been played. So there's a lot to go off of there. Svitolina with a great run will rise in the rankings a little bit after this tournament performance as well. But of course, Sabalenka in the finals took on Elena Rybakina because she beat Jessica Pegula, who was the six seed player from the US, 6-3, 7-6. So two set matches there. And in the finals, as we talked about in predictions, Rybakina beat Sabalenka. I talked about the head-to-head kind of at length, so I'm really not going to go too much in depth there. But obviously for Rybakina, it's great for her to get on the board and get a Grand Slam title. It's her first since 2022 when she won Wimbledon, and she won the World Tour Finals at the end of last year. And of course, that was over, or at least I know she beat Sabalenka somewhere on the road there, which again, this is what I was talking about when I was talking about that head-to-head. But still, you look at her other tournament results. I mean, her career best, other than the wins at Wimbledon and now the Australian Open, two quarterfinal appearances in the French Open and a fourth round at the US Open last year. So can easily improve on those this year, especially with the momentum that she's now carrying forward. She's a great, great player, and obviously, you know, has won on grass before. That's her Grand Slam title, but really on the hard court has shown a lot, especially in the recent season, or end to the recent season, and then continuing into this season. But of course, congrats to Elena Rybakina. But that will wrap up this edition of the 4th and 24 podcast. Please be sure to check out our next edition of the podcast, which will be on Tuesday, February 10th, where we will once again talk about my weekend predictions, talk about the Super Bowl, and have our weekly review of the NBA and college basketball. Of course, no tennis there because it's not a Grand Slam anymore. But in the meantime, be sure to check out my predictions for next weekend's games, which will be posted as always on Thursdays, and my college hoops bracketology, which comes out every Monday, although maybe could be Monday and Friday going forward. I haven't decided if we've hit the point of the year where that's necessary yet. But all of that content, regardless of if those bracketology updates start being bi-weekly or just day-weekly, will be on our social media handles at 4th and 24. That's the number 4, THAND, the number 24. Thank you for listening.